Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Take a deep breath, wash your hands for 20 seconds, and don't touch your face. We're talking about the coronavirus out of China. Before we have a solid grasp of its spread, its pre-symptomatic incubation time, and its kill rate among all the people who catch the virus, neither do we have the means of testing big populations yet, much less a vaccine to inoculate us. We are speaking of a black swan in the form of a microscopic new bug that tears at commerce and culture all over the world. No school, all schools in Pakistan, in Japan, in Italy, just for example. And on the trade routes across the Pacific, we've got a pileup of stalled container ships between China and the California ports of Oakland and Long Beach. The plague for our times hasn't yet sorted itself between impulses to cancel everything or brave it out, to shore up our borders or get our heads into a borderless crisis, an age of pandemics. The historian Frank Snowden has made a life's work of connecting epidemics and society, of seeing plagues one by one as mirrors of the world they infest. I asked him this week to help us see our times and ourselves in this coronavirus.
We have to realize that globalization is with us. It's a fact. And whatever happens in Kinshasa or Jakarta this morning will happen in New York, San Francisco, and London by evening. And so we really are inescapably part of one world. Diseases are not something that are just random happenings. They follow the ecological niches that societies have created. Mm-hmm. And we've created a society that has 7.8 billion people, that is intensely urbanized, that has immediate transportation by airline, that mm-hmm. has a very perilous relationship with the environment, and therefore with animal populations. And it's not by chance, then, that microbes that are good at transferring from animals to people as their habitat is destroyed, and viruses that exploit dense populations and populations that are immediately mobile. That's a really important part of why epidemic diseases, and particularly viral diseases, are becoming increasingly prominent in our history. And as we're seeing, they then have the capacity to unravel societies, to unravel economies, to stop trade and the production of goods and services, to make people look over their shoulder and think that they should exclude foreigners or particular ethnic groups or class groups.
Frank Snowden, we're all trying to get our heads around it. Take two possible frames. To think of it, A, as an environmental problem, symptom, result, that we are crowding the natural life of the planet. What does that mean, even? Is it true?
Yes, it is true that we are clearly destroying rainforests at a prodigious and reckless rate around the globe, from palm trees to the rainforest in the Amazon, the wildfires raging in Australia, California, and so on. And that has consequences. And it's not by chance, then, that human beings are driven inevitably much, much into closer relationships with bats and other animals that have diseases that human beings have never experienced before. And so once there's a spillover to human beings, then the possibility of that human-to-human transmission is extremely, extremely possible. Because remember that we evolve very, very slowly, but viruses have new generations in matters of minutes. And so mutations are occurring with incredible rapidity. Viruses have the sort of natural advantage in this contest between human beings and microbes. Mm. And what human beings have is their intelligence if they're prepared to use it. That's the drama that I find scary, but it's also extremely fascinating because we see a whole drama of our existence and our attitude towards it playing out before our very eyes. Mm. Are we going actually to learn the lesson of the past with the dress rehearsals that we've had with avian flu, with SARS, with MERS, with Ebola, and now with this disease?
All that comes out of trying to think of it as a fundamentally environmental problem. Try another frame. You've also spoken of these plagues as moral dramas. What should we be seeing?
What we're seeing in terms of a moral drama is whether human beings are going to accept that in order on the positive side to deal with this effectively, they have to put into place mechanisms that reflect our unity, the fact that this is a boat in which the fate of everyone is involved, versus the point of view, the dark side of human nature, that we can simply throw up barriers, walls, and be protected behind them, a sort of great Trumpian wall that we can be behind and feel safe. And so I think it is this great moral drama being enacted in front of us of, will we as human beings realize that we're all interlinked inescapably?
Frank Snowden, you had a personal confrontation with a cholera epidemic in Italy in 1973. It may have got you started on these researches. It came out of Naples and was then forgotten. What did people learn from that experience or not learn?
Right. It indicates a refusal to learn, the tendency to blame people who are suffering from the disease for the disease. That is to say, there were, you know, attacks on people from Naples. There were attacks on poor people in Naples. There was a sort of idea that they were responsible, the poor were the ones who were the bearers of this disease. In actual fact, the disease broke out through mussels feeding on raw sewage in the Bay of Naples. Mm. That's actually where it started and spread from there. And that was something that was predictable and foreseeable. That's the sad story of how it began.
Frank Snowden, I can't help noticing, I mean, in our presidential campaign, there is a candidate who in every appearance says medicine is a human right. Healthcare is a human right. Can he be right?
Everything that I read and see indicates to me that if we don't have health care as a right for every person, that we will not have health for the whole of us. And that is to say that if there are people who are beyond medical care, the state doesn't even know when they're sick or when they're not. And therefore, the public health depends on the accurate, timely, rapid information. And if there are 30 million Americans who are outside the system, that means there are 30 million people among whom a disease like coronavirus could spread rampant before anyone knew about it, because those people would not seek medical care and no one would know that they were sick. It would be like having the Titanic sinking in your own backyard and not knowing it.
What do you take to be the lesson of the AIDS epidemic?
It began with denial. Ronald Reagan refused to talk about AIDS. So we need to learn from the AIDS epidemic that stigmatization is one of the things that actually is worst response to a disease, because it drives the disease underground and the health authorities won't know about it because people who are suffering won't seek medical care. Mm. So stigmatization is a driver of epidemics.
Frank Snowden, you've spoken of the coronavirus moment as a dress rehearsal. How will we know the main event?
Well, the thing about coronavirus is that it isn't the main event. It's a disease that's transmitted not by transient contact, but in clusters of people in a family, in a hospital setting, in a closed place. That's one of the limits of the disease, thank heavens. And another limit of the disease, compared with many others, is that its actual case fatality rate is the technical term for what we might call more in the vernacular, the kill rate of the disease, is something like, it varies from country to country, but it's more like 2.5-3%, which pales in comparison with 50% for bubonic plague. We'll know an apocalyptic worst-case scenario when and if we have a disease that's transmissible by the air at a distance, like measles and smallpox, and that has also a very high kill rate, and for which there is not yet a vaccine or a treatment. And so it immediately overwhelms our healthcare systems, which simply don't have the capacity to deal with these vast numbers of sick and terribly sick and ill people. And we're blessed that, dreadful though coronavirus is, we know it's not the catastrophe that could come upon us.
Frank Snowden, we don't brag about political wisdom on these matters, but I've just been reminded in this time of a remarkable line at the end of President Kennedy's American University speech in 1963. He was thinking of war, but think of it now in terms of epidemics. What he said was, in the final analysis, what we have to understand is that we live on a small planet, we breathe the same air, as he would have said, we love our children, and finally, that we're mortal.
Right.
We need to hear that again.
I couldn't agree with you more. That sounds like a message for our time. Let's post that in public places for people to remember.
Frank Snowden's giant book from the Yale University Press last year is Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. He spoke to us from Rome. Coming up, public health in its emergency coming of age. This is Open Source. The movie Contagion from 2011 was almost a decade ahead of the news. Steven Soderbergh's imagining of a viral pandemic. The hope in that horror show was the heroism of warriors inside the CDC, like the woman played by Kate Winslet, here describing the peril of touching your face in a plague.
So at this point, I think we have to believe this is respiratory. Maybe fomites, too.
What's that, fomites?
It refers to transmission from surfaces. The average person touches their face 2,000 or 3,000 times a day.
2,000 or 3,000 times a day?
3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, elevator buttons, and each other. Those things become fomites.
Dr. Nahid Padelia is our clinician on the case. She's an infectious diseases physician who worked on the Ebola treatment in the West African crisis of 2015. She is medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit at the Boston University School of Medicine and at the Level 4 program in the National Emerging and Infectious Diseases, known as NEEDLE. Welcome, Nahid Badelia. What are the, in your mind, the key knowns and unknowns in this very perplexing situation?
I think the main thing is that we know that we're in the middle of a public health emergency. Secretary Azar of Health and Human Services on January 31st of this year said that because of the current coronavirus crisis, America needs to prepare. The health systems in America need to prepare. We know also that there will be more cases seen in the United States. We've seen that in other countries that have more sustained transmission. And what we don't know, though, is how many more cases that will be. And the other thing that we know is that all of us at different levels, at the government, the public health, at the healthcare facility level, and the individual level will have to take actions to change our everyday processes to make sure that we mitigate and contain this disease.
People can't avoid trying the numbers here. Mark Lipsitch at the Harvard University School of Public Health was saying, and it's around, that the roughly half of our population, 40%, 60%, roughly half will be touched by this infection. At a 1% kill rate, which is low as these things go, we're talking about millions of people could die. Can that be?
I think that, you know, we should prepare for the worst, but hope for the best, you know, because there's so many moving pieces that we don't know about this yet. When will we develop the vaccine? You know, how will the weather affect the spread of this disease? Yes, there will be a lot more people than we currently see that are going to be affected, and many of them will be ill, then will require medical facility level care. We're probably going to see an increase in the number of people who are requiring that here in the United States, which is going to place a pressure on our healthcare systems. But to start off at, we have to sort of take into account how good our containment and mitigating processes are at the medical level and the public health level.
You know, in Frank Snowden's mirror, as he put it, of ourselves in this pandemic, I see mostly confusion, uncertainty, mystery, why we didn't develop the vaccine, for example, why we don't have the facilities to test our population.
Yeah, I think that we are, in my opinion, we are very much behind on the testing part. I think that we cannot plan around what we do not know. And the more we test, the better idea we will get. And maybe we'll find out that this is more geographically localized, and we'll know what the good strategies are, what the strategies are to help sort of limit this, the spread of this disease based on that. The vaccine part, it doesn't seem like it, but I actually think is a success. It takes a long period of time from the point where you find a new pathogen to be able to develop a vaccine with the current technology. There are limits of this that you can improve. For example, at the very beginning, coming up with the actual vaccine, if you put enough resources on that and if you have enough manpower beforehand, you can develop a candidate. And on the distribution and manufacturing part, you can also sort of rush the process and improve that. In the middle is a whole bit that's about testing the efficacy and the safety of this vaccine in the people that you're going to give it to. And that's the part that takes space, and that's a limit that can't be changed. So from that perspective, I think we're moving ahead.
I'm still thinking of that movie, Contagion, which anticipated a lot of this. Big question for everybody, are we doing enough? Are we aggressive enough? Compared, say, to China, which should have canceled those lunar festivals, but since then has been very authoritarian, very forceful, very interventionist with their own population.
We are a different society and culture than China. And one of the basic tenets of the American society is the individual liberties. And public health, particularly during pandemics, it's a social contract between what liberties you're giving up for the potential good of others. So the other bit of, you know, what I think people should know is that we truly are in this together in every sense of the word. You know, things that you do to protect yourself protects other people. And the things that you do to protect other people limits your chances of getting infected because there will be fewer people around you who have this disease.
We're going to come back to this sort of what could be the dawn of a new age in public health. But I want to introduce Kyle Harper. He's a classical historian who's now learning modern biology. He's a student of ancient Rome and infectious diseases. Welcome, Kyle Harper. Start with the links that you found in your new book called The Fate of Rome.
Well, thanks. In the Fate of Rome, I talk about the historic pandemics that swept the Roman Empire in the 2nd century, the 3rd century, again in the 6th century. And I think one of the lessons that's relevant for us today is simply that evolution, the evolution of pathogens, is highly unpredictable. and has been a destabilizing force in human history. And as a historian who specializes in a very distant time period, it's fascinating to watch these events unfolding around us. It's almost as though we're watching history unfold before our very eyes.
Yeah, we're at another intersection of climate, disease, and empire. So what should we have learned? And what did the Romans understand about this? We've always blamed the Huns or the Visigoths or the barbarians for the fall of Rome. What is the core of this new story in that sense?
Right.
It's a lesson for us.
And the Rome's enemies certainly had a role to play. But what we've increasingly learned is that that's not the whole story, that when we look back at the past, we now have the tools, thanks to the natural sciences, whether it's paleoclimate or whether it's the study of pathogen genomes, to know more than the Romans ever could have about the environment in which they lived. So the Romans themselves had really only a very rudimentary understanding of health and medicine, and certainly very different cultural terms, and for instance, lacked even germ theory that would have allowed them to understand and explain the microscopic causes of the diseases that they suffered. So their understanding of events was certainly not what we would consider modern scientific explanation. It was religious otherwise kind of in terms of miasma. But we now have tools that are helping us reconstruct the history of infectious diseases like the coronavirus in recent times, but stretching back and looking at bacterial diseases like bubonic plague, and even in some cases, viral diseases like measles.
The biology is incredible. As if you could trace the lineage, the ancestry of a virus, as you can sort of dope out your family history from your DNA. Is that what we're doing?
That's exactly right, and at very different timescales. And so what's happening right now in very real time is molecular tracking of the outbreak of the coronavirus, the present pandemic. And you'll read stories, for instance, about how it can be traced back to late 2019 to central China. But those same kinds of tools, the use of genetics to build family trees of germs, lets us peer really deep into the past. And so we know a lot more than we used to about the ancestry of diseases like measles, like smallpox, like bubonic plague.
Kyle Harper, what would a modern history of public health, the general idea of a social responsibility, look like?
Well, I think public health is one of the really great triumphs of our species, and it's really one of the distinctive triumphs of the last three centuries or so. And really, public health emerges sometimes earlier than we think it does. But at least by the 18th and 19th century, there is a growing sense that clean water is important, that sanitation and hygiene are important. And although it takes time for these ideas to prevail widely and to become policy, and in many cases, the mechanisms through which these kinds of public health measures help to combat infectious disease and improve the human condition weren't totally understood at the time, but there was still a kind of scientific approach to building societies that were healthier that we really owe, in many ways, we owe the modern human achievement to the spread of good health.
We think of the cleaning up of water and mining town atmospheres in 19th century England or 20th century England is a very big deal. How did that happen?
Well, in some ways, the 19th century is very complex because the growth of massive urban settlements in the 19th century posed enormous health challenges. And so in some ways, it was a step backwards because there wasn't simply the public infrastructure to maintain, for instance, sewage systems. And so there are actually many ways in which industrialization in the early 19th century in particular worsened human health. And at the same time, there was a lot going on in the opposite direction. And so you have kind of countervailing forces. And one of the most important really is clean water. Clean water is probably the most important health resource of all. And both technologies and what we might call civil engineering approaches changed dramatically over the 19th and even into the early 20th century that led to dramatic improvements.
Who was William Budd among the great Victorians?
William Budd is one of the unsung heroes of public health. He was an English country doctor who was stationed in Western England. He'd studied in Paris and had the best training of the day. And he became fascinated by and focused on typhoid fever, which is a bacterial pathogen, but was one of the really great killers of humanity down to the very late 19th century. And because he was out in the country and he wasn't in London, he could more clearly track cases. And he understood that typhoid fever was both a contagious disease, but also that it was caused by contaminated drinking water. And so he really both understood the importance of separating sewage from drinking water, and that what caused the disease was an infectious organism that entered the human body through contaminated drinking water. So he's really a remarkable person, and the establishment tried to shut out his ideas because most people didn't believe in germ theory in London in the mid-19th century. And ultimately, he was vindicated. He was ahead of his time, and he was a very humane person. He had a deep sense of the ways in which human societies are interconnected, and the health of one person always affects the health of another.
Nahid Bhadelia, I want to go back to public health today. I've always thought of public health as a kind of stepchild of heroic individual docs. At the same time, we had an interesting moment at the Harvard School of Public Health this week. There was an interesting briefings, but what struck my eye was the vast numbers, it seemed, of young public health doctors, a lot of them female, all kinds of complexions and national origins. But one sensed a generation of important public people being formed here in this crisis.
Yeah, and that's true of every big epidemic. I think it creates a new set of experts and then help the next generation that face the next epidemic sort of move through that. One thing that I want to go back to a little bit is, you know, you said earlier, Frank said this, that diseases hold up a mirror to our society. One thing that they're learning, these students are learning, is that a lot of the public health accomplishments that Kyle just mentioned are still, we're still suffering from some of the main diseases. The mirror that's being held up to our world is that the typhoid fever still exists in some parts of the world. People are still dying of pollution from mining. And there's a coexisting in the same space, in the same world as in places like Boston that has a lot more access. The perfect example of this is the disease that you mentioned that I worked with, Ebola.
I was going to ask you, take us back to those front lines.
So Ebola is a disease that was thought for, Ebola virus disease is a disease that was thought to basically have a mortality of 90% since we discovered it from in 1976 and onwards. And the interesting part of this is we now know that mortality of any disease is a function as much of the disease and the person as it is of the health system in which it finds itself. Because since then, we found out that when you are transported to a modern healthcare system after being infected, as many expats did who were working in West Africa during that epidemic, your mortality could drop to less than 20%, even without a definitive sort of targeted therapy against that disease. And so I think that with coronavirus, you're sort of going to see the same thing play out, where you might see that mortalities look very good in societies that are resilient, that are able to respond in a timely manner, and they may be much higher in those that don't have that capacity.
How do you move those numbers?
I think that we need to think back in the fact that every time we get to this point in the middle of a pandemic, we're always behind. We're always rushing to find resources, and it takes time to take those resources and turn them into intervention. A perfect example is, again, the Ebola epidemic. By the time a public health emergency was declared in August of 2014, resources didn't come into the ground until November 2014, which is really when you saw a turnaround, you know, in the epidemic, along with the behavior changes on the part of the populations and other things. So we have to do this beforehand. We need to build a global resilience. It's not just what is my healthcare system look like, but realize that the healthcare system in Jakarta, the healthcare system in Kinshasa matters because if we miss an outbreak there is an outbreak everywhere. An outbreak here is an outbreak, you know, across the world.
What formed you generationally? What was the crisis of your growing up?
I think I was at the, I was feeling the tail end, I think in my generation, we were feeling the tail end of the HIV epidemic. HIV has been recognized as two epidemics, right? You have the HIV epidemic and the AIDS epidemic. The idea that you're taking out functional adults who are part of many communities in low resource areas that were educators, that were healthcare workers, and realizing the impact that infectious diseases can have on entire societies and the shape that they take for the future is what shaped me, I think.
Kyle Harper, read the mirror in your own terms of the present crisis.
Well, I think, as I said, we're watching history unfold before us, which to me is one of the most fascinating features of this this pandemic. And humans are really, in some ways, we're very strange in the number of respiratory viruses that we have, measles, smallpox, but also the sort of low-level infections that were just part of being a human being, and from the common cold to the respiratory syncytial virus that so many children contract. We're a strange species in that way. Most other primate species don't have a huge number of permanently established, highly acute respiratory viruses. And these viruses have emerged over the course of the last several thousand years through a pattern that we're seeing happen right in front of our eyes, where a zoonotic disease, in this case probably a bat disease, adapts perhaps through an intermediate species, and then acquires through evolution the ability to infect humans and transmit between humans. And it's still too early to tell whether this is going to establish itself permanently as a new human disease or whether we'll be able to stop it in its tracks. It looks like it's on its way to establishing possibly as a new human disease. And so in that sense, we're seeing a pattern of history that's very distinct to our species happen as we can watch it.
As I said, I see confusion as a main element in our mirror. Who do you count on to help us? Who's going to take charge?
Well, I think it's public health experts and epidemiologists and microbiologists who are developing vaccine platforms. I think exactly as Dr. Bedelia says, when you're responding to these events in real time, it's almost too late. And so maybe this is the wake-up event that will help us devise better solutions for the next event. And exactly as Dr. Snowden was saying, this isn't the worst conceivable disease. And so maybe one of the silver linings is that it will wake us up and make us more aware of the dangers that we face being such an interconnected global society.
Kyle Harper, don't go away. Coming up, a short course in prepping for an epidemic. This is Open Source. James Haywood, known as Jamie, has made a career as a self-reliant freelance in healthcare reform, working the gaps between academic biotech and hospital medicine. He was propelled into it by his brother Stephen's battle in his 20s with Lou Gehrig's disease. 15 years ago, as his brother was dying, Jamie founded Patients Like Me to push research and reform from the people up. Got to say, Jamie, I'm touched by the memory of an ALS show we did with you and Stephen almost 20 years ago, I think.
Yeah, it was a great experience.
You seem to shuttle in public and private enterprise with observation. I'm dying to hear your view of our system.
Yeah, so I think the thing that I got from Stephen's illness, and maybe it was just trained from my parents, is to sort of ask the question, what's the why of the why? And, you know, and you know, you look at a disease like ALS and you say, why haven't we cured it? And then you work on the treatment. And then you say, well, the real driving factor is we can't measure it. And if you can't measure it, so you sort of keep going up the chain to say, how do you understand something so you can address it and make it better? And I think that has sort of led to being thoughtful about what shapes us, what shapes our behaviors, how we as a society respond as opposed to be intentional and think about things. And in the case of this virus, I think it's a classic example of sort of having all the information. You know, I work as part of the Biosurveillance Advisory Committee for the CDC 10 years ago, and we have all the information. We knew this was going to happen. We didn't know it was going to be this virus. We didn't know, you know, all the exact numbers, but this was known, and you know, the government knows. And what happens is we don't really prepare for these kinds of disruptions. And I think it's much in the same way that we don't, as humans, take care of our health, and then we're surprised when something comes along and knocks us off our feet.
Much less the planet or the atmosphere.
Much less the planet, everything. So I think this is about, a lesson in that we live, you know, as you said earlier, we're a single species on a small planet. We are
stressed.
That
was JFK and Ted Sorensen, yeah. I think.
But I think the question is there. And then you asked, how do I approach this? One of the things I learned with Stephen is that, you know, you're living with, someone you love dearly on a respirator, and you're subject to the risks of infectious diseases, and they can be deadly in that context and quite significant. And so you're aware of this. And so you think about preparing. You think about how do you travel safely. You think about how do you have the resources if the power goes out because you're using, you know, equipment. And that becomes part of your life. And I think that this should be part of the way we live our world. Like, we should prepare for things to go wrong. And this is something that's going wrong.
From the sublime to the very practical, two things. One, what is it that works in our system and it doesn't? Where are the biggest gaps? But then I also want you to describe how you prep in this moment.
So, I think that one of the amazing things about it, the capitalism, and you mentioned jumping between public and private. You know, so I've built several companies, and the capitalism allows for this amazing invention and efficiency of execution. It produces, produces the digital experience that we're having right now. It produces this sort of amazing ability to connect everyone and deliver food very inexpensively, and heat and all the things, water, all the stuff of public health you talked about earlier. This is a product, a delivery product of capitalism. But what I think we forget is that something asks for that. There's an intention that says we need to structure our world such that thing gets delivered. And that is something that when we become too efficient, we forget that the world shifts, things happen. And so the problem with capitalism is that the efficiency is also fragility. That when you have just-in-time manufacturing, as you said, how much food is on the East Coast? How much energy is in our supply systems? And if you have a significant disruption, let alone ventilators at Boston Medical Center, right?
So redundancy or flexibility or emergency thinking is not built into our system, it sounds like.
Exactly. And by the way, it's not in the way we live our lives. We don't get enough sleep, and therefore we get sick. You know, if you want to not get the virus, sleep tonight. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You know, eat well, sleep, and exercise, and you are less likely to both have it land in you and also make you ill. And then if it does make you ill, you're more likely to live. I mean, it's just fairly straightforward.
Hey, does this picture of an over-efficient, capitalized, very profitable, very expensive medical system, is that what you're looking at?
I think that system carries both advantages and disadvantages, right? I think that if, yes, there are disadvantages to it. There's definitely advantages to it. But I think it also, to me, it's beyond that. I think we forget how much of medicine itself is globalized now as well.
Meaning what?
So on Tuesday, there was a congressional hearing about the coronavirus. And one of the things that was mentioned were some of the essential medications required on the list for United States for public health were those that had components that were produced in China and then manufactured by India under the supervision of FDA. Well, China is in the middle of a public health crisis. And as that happens, India can't manufacture it. And hence, our source of those medications is now threatened. It's the same with our food source, same with other things. We're globally connected, and it's not something we can just switch off, I think. You know, it's one of the major lessons of this.
I want to know how you're prepping. What this is for you, Jamie, but what is in your kit? Or in your cellar, or in your freezer.
So I think the important. I'm a little resistant to the word prepping, but let's just say to be prepared. You can't do it when things start to go wrong, and it's actually not good for society. It's not good for the world. But I think that that we live under the assumptions that when we go to the grocery store, there will be food. You know, when we need to go and get energy, it will be there. The electricity will always be on. And history shows that that's not actually particularly true. And it's not that you know, it's just a statement of historical sort of data. And so the question is, you know, rather than going and buying that fancy new object or whatever it is, it might make more sense to prepare for there be to be less opportunities to do that. So I think at some level it's just, you know, be prepared to live without support, not in some bunker, not in something.
But be practical.
Just, let's be practical.
Should we all be wearing gloves, by the way? Should we be stockpiling lentils?
You know, I do want to touch on the germ theory component of this. I think that there is definitely evidence that slowing the spread of this is going to, we'll learn how to manage it better, and there will be a lot of other benefits to that. But I think that we should also not be under the illusion that you can prevent yourself from getting this. This is ultimately, I mean, my family, since the day this started coming out in China, I looked at the numbers, we have been under the assumption that everyone in the family will get this. And I think that's another thing about being prepared. Like, we have a son with asthma that is virally triggered. And, you know, we have had to go to the ER to get steroids and oxygen and the things that you would need to do to manage that. And I do not believe, I am not operating an assumption that ER will be there in the event of a real crisis.
Wow. What does your ER look like?
Well, it's just the basic set of things. Now, it's easier in my family because there's a clinician. My wife is a clinician, but we have essentially a low tech setup. I mean, that's the same thing we did when we took care of my brother when he was on a ventilator. I mean, it's not going to be a replacement for great medical care, but you know, if we get infection rates 30%, we're not going to have great medical care.
Yeah.
Nahid, are you prepping?
I am, but in a different way. I think there's a reality between doing nothing and having a bunker with the lentils and everything else. And I'm not a proponent of the latter. I think preparedness in the middle is actually a recognition of what it is. What are the knowns? And the knowns are, in majority of the people, this is going to be a mild disease. This is going to be a disease that causes very few symptoms. What effects it will have on you is that you may need to stay home from work. You know, if there's a school closure, your kids may have to stay home. You have to figure out how to provide them with support. There are other logistic things that there might be events that are canceled. You may not be able to go for travel where you want to because there might be a sustained public health emergency there. And so the kind of things that I sort of think about, and I know I'm talking to my family about preparing, is for the regular person, it's make sure, you know, if you're going to get sick and you live alone, or if you're going to have multiple people sick in your family, you have just enough medications, you know, just fever reducers or things that control symptoms, enough food that if you have to quarantine yourself or if you're homesick that you're able to sort of provide for yourself for food. And then the normal things that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, ensuring you wash your hands, you know, making sure you keep your distance from people who are sick. And if you're sick yourself, not going into work. And then if you are that group of people, the 14% that we have seen that are older, who have other medical conditions, one of the main advice that I can give you is make sure you refill your prescriptions and you have those medications, similar to what you were just saying, Jamie, which is making sure you have those emergency medications available.
Carl Hopper, I want you back in on a sort of a general essay question. Actually, two parts. One, it seems to me the tilt of our mindset in America is individualistic medicine. Practitioners and patients are all sort of freelancing on their own. Second, and even the genomic medicine in which we're now addressing your DNA and mine and repairing snippets is also individualized. Second broad question is about globalization itself. We thought we were in an anti-global trend. Nationalism, you know, to the fore in all sorts of countries, including our own. And suddenly we face a situation in which our global connections may be the key to our survival as a species. How are we going to deal with this, and who's going to win? Kyle, do you want to take a whack?
Sure. And I think to answer the first question about our individualistic society. It's a great point, and I think it'll be one of the interesting things to watch as this pandemic continues over the next several months, because I think our society will in some ways be challenged. And one of the lenses through which I look at this as a administrator at our university, and it's already been fascinating to watch the preparedness protocols as we're really planning and thinking through scenarios in a way that certainly in my lifetime we've never had to. And I think one of the things that you'll see is institutions kind of between the individual and the state, like universities, like churches, scrambling to respond, to find best practices, to try and make good decisions for members of their communities. And so that'll be one of the really, I think, important arenas, is what happens to public spaces, to large gatherings, to sporting events, to entertainment events, to religious events. And the American response will be different from the Chinese response, will be different from the European response. But that'll be something that this isn't something that we've lived through, at least in the last few generations. So watching that will be fascinating, and maybe will provide us lessons learned that we can use in the event of future pandemics.
Nahid, I wonder, are we ready to deal with the fact that we all breathe the same air, and that's where the problem is, in the air we breathe?
Yeah, thankfully the disease we don't think is majorly transmitted as airborne, as Kate Winslet said at the beginning of the show, but it is transmitted by, you know, people potentially sneezing and coughing and you being in the area. No, I think we need to work a little bit on that. And I'll tell you why. One example is I was quarantined twice after I returned from West Africa. And it was this personal responsibility that I had to take, you know, and with the help of the state, and just ensuring that I was keeping my distance. I was maintaining social distance. And that's a healthcare worker. You know, it was difficult for me, and it was challenging, psychologically challenging. And now if we're moving to potential spaces where you might have to quarantine large groups of people who may not necessarily understand, you know, why this is being done, because I do think there's been an erosion of public health in this country. How will we do this? And I do think the main things that we need to do in the public health world and elsewhere, I think, is community engagement. We need to be upfront, out there to talk about what this means and why those public health measures are being taken. We need to answer people's questions, you know, to make sure that that is what allays fears and that's what buys cooperation.
Jamie, it's still an argument in our politics very currently whether everybody should be covered. Of course.
Yeah, well, that's I love watching the discussions about you go and you get charged for this unapproved new test, and then the medical bankruptcies will be the biggest consequence of this in some way. But let's just skip the absurdity of the fact that is a discussion in a time when we are all threatened by something completely different.
No, but I'm talking about the lesson of the age thing is that it wasn't about there was a disease there, and to isolate the victim population was to promote the disease.
I think let's stay on the age thing for a second, because I think that there's sort of something we have to think about here. Like when we talk about prepping for a second, prepping doesn't mean something's inevitable, right? It doesn't mean that you're planning for it. Like, so if you ask me what I think will happen versus what I'm preparing for, I am preparing for low percentage events. We all should prepare for low percentage events. What we think is going to happen, I think we're largely going to manage this. It's going to be painful, but I think it's likely to me, given what I understand, that we're going to be able to manage this, and it's going to be difficult and painful. And
on the scale of World War One flu,
This is not going to be World War One flu, but that's what it looks like. But sorry, I won't say this does not probabilistically does not look like it's going to be World War One flu. But I do think that, go back to the AIDS epidemic thing, and, I was one of the last generations of kids that got through college before AIDS became a major issue at a social level, forget the medical level. And the difference between my generation and the kids 5 years younger than us was profound in our social behavior, just a profound shift caused by a virus that had a very low percentage implication of the population. So, I think that
The first discovery that sex could kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not the first discovery,
but one
that was very visible and stigmatized, actually. But if you look at the this case, I think that you go to the AIDS academic thing, I think the interesting question, and you know, this, you look at how the markets are oscillating up and down about this, what will happen if this does what's likely to happen, which is this becomes a systemic flu-like virus? And likely doesn't mean, but that's the most likely scenario. And if that happens, this is going to change how we travel. This is going to change how we live. It's going to change. And I think that just like HIV changed how we related. And I think what I think we should do as a society is be intentional about how we make some of these decisions as opposed to just reactionary. So we just live with what we decide as individuals things without really discussing or thinking about or being intentional. And the world is too small. These consequences are too great. We have too much power to destroy ourselves and systems to not at this point take this as a lesson to be intentional.
Kyle Harper, you get a last word. What's to be done other than to keep talking about it?
I think share good information and try and allay people's fears. It's not so much the virus that ought to really scare us, but the ways that a disease event like this can intersect other problems or structural weaknesses we have. And so as we go into an election year, as we live in a world with a difficult geopolitical arrangement, we have to worry about the way that these unpredictable events can intercept other problems that we have in our world. So yeah. Staying calm, trusting science, allaying fears.
Do we even dare think about this as a presidential election issue? That's for next time. Thank you, Nahid Bedelia, Jamie Haywood, Kyle Harper. Thanks also to Frank Snowden. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our germ catcher. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.